Thank you very much, Surya Gupta. Delighted to be here to give my second talk at the London Buddhist Centre on Dardo Rinpoche. On the first one, which was decades ago, I talked for so long that they had to ring the bell at the end and say, come back another time. So I never got the chance to finish the talk, and I have no idea where I was in that talk, so I'll have to start at the beginning again. But this time I'll make it shorter. I wrote The Wheel and the Diamond, the story of Dardo Rinpoche, 33 years ago, and I'm working on doing another version of it. Not a highly changed version, but the book has been out of print for a long, long time. You can get it secondhand from anywhere between £15 and £60. So for a paperback at £60, that's too much, isn't it? But I've got 5 copies left that were on my bookshelf, and I'm giving them to Surya Gupta so that she can auction them for fundraising for things connected with the centre here. If you want to go up to £60, yeah, 70, 80, 100, why not? My story with Dardo Rinpoche goes back to my first visit to India back in 1985-86, and I was visiting our Buddhist community, the Dalit or ex-untouchable Buddhist community out in India, working with them, but I wanted also to go up and see Dardo Rinpoche. I'd heard so many stories from our teacher Sangha Rinpoche. When I was in Kalimpong, and then your ears would prick up, and he would tell you things that happened in Kalimpong, and many of them were connected with Dardo Rinpoche. So I wanted to go and visit him. So the journey up there is another story. That's not one for today. I've written it, but it's not been published. But I got to Kalimpong, and some of the readings we had this morning, people meeting Dardo Rinpoche, it was like that, just sort of overwhelming. You got such an expectation and such a sort of keyed up sort of hope and everything just there already, and you're there and you can't get the words out because what do you say? So I just laughed and giggled, and Dardo Rinpoche did the same, thank goodness. But that on that first visit, I had the idea to try and collect some information about his life. And some other people had also been visiting him and collected some information. So Dardo Rinpoche was, he was ready to share his life story. So I had bunch of questions. Sangha Rinpoche gave me an extra 25 questions, which is a lot, and we got through the whole lot. 2 years later I went back, and that's the video that you saw this morning, where Dardo Rinpoche is speaking. I've asked the question. So I've been there, and I've watched those little clips many times, and relived being there and just being with him and seeing how he handled things. I'll give you a little bit of the outline of his life, not very much, because I'm hoping that you'll either buy one of the auctioned books or that you'll wait, that later on this year, I hope, we'll have a new edition out. So, as Surya Gupta said, that he was regarded as an incarnate lama, a tulku, somebody who had a previous life called Dardo Rinpoche, and that when he died, they then searched for the new young boy, and they found this one, and they thought, this is the Darda Rinpoche. And of course his the place where they found him was a place called Dartsendo. And they searched in Dartsendo for this young boy being reborn there, because Dartsendo was where the previous Tulku came from. And he was called Darda Rinpoche because he came from Dartsendo, Dardo. So that's what Dardo means. It means the precious one from the town of Dartsendo. I went there last year to visit the monastery that he was connected with, well, visit the two monasteries he was connected with, and to try and find out a bit more of the backstory. I found out there is a backstory, but I'm not getting it. And why I'm not getting it is probably part of the story as well. So it's going to come out, you know, we'll find out the backstory, but I think there's some sort of unease around it, because the previous Dardo Rinpoche belonged to one particular school of Buddhism, but converted to the other one, and those two schools were not, they didn't have an easy relationship with each other. One was the ancient school and one was the newly reformed school. So maybe the monks and the abbots of the old monastery are thinking, oh, is there a new Darda Rinpoche going to come and take over our monastery now? We haven't seen him for 150 years. So they were not really willing to share very much of the story. That's maybe something of what was going on. But the story will come out, no doubt. But that great previous Tulku, he went from Dartsendo, which is right on the edge of, right on the border between China and Old Tibet, and left there when he was 9 years old and went to Lhasa, where the big monasteries, the big newly reformed sect or school, had their monasteries. And there he became, he went through all the education, and he became the abbot of one of the largest of the colleges there. And before the end of his life, when he was in his 80s, he was such a renowned figure that everybody knew who he was. And when he died back in 1917-18, they then discovered our Darda Tulku, who's on the shrine there, discovered him back in Dartsendo, brought him back to Lhasa, and then of course he had to live up to the reputation of his previous incarnation. He had to become as good as that. So you can imagine the pressure that was on him, that, you know, oh, your previous incarnation could do this, he did that, he was so wonderful, why can't you be like that? You're such a naughty boy. And like growing up, incredible pressure. But as he told us, and when I was questioning on his life story, that, yeah, he was a naughty boy, but it was tough. And it wasn't until he was round about 18 or 19, he said, when actually he began to get the bug of studying seriously. And he really studied seriously. And yeah, when he was 26, graduated the top of the top. Well, actually not quite the top. He was top equal. And the ruling in Lhasa was that if there was the examination and two were equal, the top place would be given to the one who had to travel the furthest for that exam. So his debate partner was from Mongolia. So yeah, our Darda Rinpoche took second place. But second equal, top equal. And then something happened to him that just after he'd finished his study and his exams and so on, which was also a very costly affair, because you had to offer round of tea to all the monks in the monastery. 7,000 monks. And when he was debating in other monasteries, which had 5,000 and 3,000 monks, again had to make offerings of tea and sponsor food meals for the big monks and so on. Basically, it was costing something like, back in the money of the 1940s, it was costing something like £50,000, which is an incredible amount for them to raise for that. And his household was not a rich household. He had to get it from donations. So it was a huge strain on him. Straight after his exams, his health collapsed. Probably sponsored, not sponsored, it's not the right word, sparked by the death of his own guru, who suddenly just died at the end of Dhamma Rinpoche's studies. And his guru said, you know, as he was passing away, he said, look, don't worry about me. I've done my duty. I was sent. That was the sort of the word he used. I was sent with one purpose, and that was to educate you, and I've done it. Now I'm going to go to a pure land and receive teachings from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Dhamma Rinpoche was left without his guru, who he loved so much. His health broke down. He couldn't get the right medications. Nobody could help him. And so he thought, well, there's only one thing I can do, is go to India. Maybe the doctors in India, because they've got a different system of medication, the Western medicine, maybe they could do something. So he went to India, went to Kalimpong, and eventually he found a doctor, and the doctor did treat him, and he came through. But he told us, actually, something which I think tells a bit more of what was going on. He said that he was lying in his bed, and his mother was out in the garden with the doctor. She was on pilgrimage also to India. And he said, oh, he was thinking that he's such a burden for his mum, such a burden for the doctor, for his disciples, his attendants. They're all worried about him, and here he is, just in bed. And he thought, I've got to change. And he got up out of his bed and said, I'm just going to go into the garden. Went into the garden. The doctor said, no, look, go back to bed. He said, no, just give me a few minutes in the garden. So he just had a few minutes in the garden. Okay, went back to bed. Next day, did the same. 2-3 days did like that, and then his health recovered. So he said that what disease he had was a disease what they would call lung. Lung is a Tibetan word which means wind. Now, it doesn't mean he had flatulence or anything like that. Wind is the element that goes through the body upon which the consciousness resides. That's their way of seeing it, that wind is the energy that travels through the body, that brings awareness with it. So he had a psychological illness. Maybe not psychological, but a psycho-spiritual illness. The loss of his guru, the strain he'd been under, the tremendous pressure to, you know, perform at the top level was just too much. And he probably burned out. So his cure was a little sort of flash of insight. I can't be a burden like this for other people. Life can't go on like that. Not for them, not for me. Okay, I have to change. Somehow the insight went deep enough for him to transform his energies and cured himself. From that point on, he didn't really have many episodes of illness for the rest of his life. But being in India had an unexpected effect. And the effect was that when he went back to Lhasa to complete the next level of studies, which were tantric studies, and another few years at Tantric College, the regent of Tibet called them and said, you have to go back to India, because there's a temple that's been given to us, and you have to go and be the abbot. And Rinpoche said, no, I've got to complete my study. And the regent said, no, you have to go. So Rinpoche said, well, I'll go after I've completed my studies. And the regent said, just go. Now, I remember him, you know, telling me, you know, the regent said, just go. There's no arguing. He had no choice. So he left. And in a sense, it was a blessing, because he was out of Tibet when the Chinese came in the 1950s. And he had a very good friend, another Mongolian monk, not the one he had been debating with, another Mongolian monk who had been in Mongolia when the communists took over in the 1930s, when something like 20 or 30,000 monks and nuns were executed. So the Mongolian monk had said that, you know, if communism gets into Tibet, there's no hope for the Dharma. And so Dharma Rinpoche decided, well, I can't go back. I can't go back. I mustn't go back. I now have a responsibility to try and keep our tradition alive here in India. And that's what he tried to do. He also knew, and he spotted the signs quite early on, that refugees were beginning to come out of Tibet because of the communist invasion. And he could see that amongst them, not just poor people, but poor children, children orphans, children with, you know, just no way to support themselves apart from begging and stealing. So he and some of his friends in Kalimpong decided to set up a school. And that's why we've been talking about the school that he had. You saw the photographs that Surya Gupta showed us, the ITBCI, the Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Cultural Institute School. That's a mouthful, isn't it? The ITBCI school. Now, this is one of the things I want to emphasize, particularly in this talk. I want to emphasize the radical nature of what he did. And I didn't understand this really until just probably even just last year. I knew it was a special school. I knew it was a very special school, but it was really radical. Only two schools were ever set up in Tibet along Western styles. First one was in 1924. By an Indian civil servant called Frank Ludlow. And he was asked to go and set up the school, and the Tibetan government would send, you know, boys to the school, not girls, I think it was just the boys. And he would teach them. He didn't get any of the resources that he wanted. He struggled all the time to keep the school going, but he managed to teach them some English, managed to teach them writing, and managed to teach them arithmetic. And that's the radical thing that happened, arithmetic. Arithmetic in Tibet at that time was done not by our system. It's done by the system that was very, very similar to what we had in Europe back in the 1200s, 1100s, 1200s, there was no proper arithmetic system in the West up until that point. Who had arithmetic? The Arabs. And the Arab traders could calculate money owed, money taken in, just really quickly, mentally. They could just do it like that. Who here has got training in accountancy? one at the back. Only one, wow. So you know that the accounting system, you have to have an in and an out. There has to be double bookkeeping, doesn't there? Double entry. There was no double entry in Europe until they learned it from the Arabs. Once the Europeans learned it from Arabs, the Venetian Empire and Venice and what's it, and Florence, it transformed their economy incredibly, which supported, of course, the Renaissance and so on. But in Tibet, they were still doing arithmetic in the old way. The bursars for the monasteries, the government finance minister and his department, all had to do arithmetic by recitation of rhymes. They had to recite, da 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 means such and such, da 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 da, add two, da 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 da, subtract three, da 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 da. And it took them ages. And these snotty-nosed kids in Frank Ludlow's school could do just like that because they had the number zero. There was no zero in the Tibetan system for calculation. And you can't calculate without zero. You can do with an abacus, and there's a placeholder for a zero, but there's no number for zero. It's not a number. It's a nothing. So these snotty-nosed kids were shaming the bursars and the accountants and the traders and so on. They could calculate things just like that. In the end, the school was closed down after just a couple of years. Another effort was made in the 1940s, and that school lasted just 3 months. That was it. Darda Rinpoche setting up school, he got teachers to teach arithmetic properly. They could do arithmetic, they learned Hindi, they learned English, and when the refugees came out, the aristocrats and the traders and all the government officials, they were all still working by medieval system. And Darda Rinpoche's pupils helped them with Hindi translation into English for dealing with English officials, and also for counting. They could just do it like that. So Darda Rinpoche then got a lot of flack from the refugees who come out, especially the government officials, because he was turning out students that were shaming the government officials. So they weren't at all behind him doing the school, but he stuck to it. And thank goodness, because eventually all the Tibetan schools in India did the same thing. Of course, the other thing he did was he taught a full Tibetan syllabus, whereas later on when Tibetan schools were set up in India, to get a grant from the Indian government to run a Tibetan school, they had to follow the full Indian syllabus, which left about an hour a day for Tibetan studies. Darda Rinpoche had a whole morning for Tibetan studies and an afternoon for everything else. Produced great pupils. So he's really, really determined in a very practical way. But underlying it was that he really wanted to preserve Tibetan culture and Tibetan Buddhism. And to do that, you had to have boys and girls that were growing up learning Tibetan language and learning writing in Tibetan. But they also had to be modern students and be able to handle English, maths, Hindi, especially those three, other ones too. But underlying it was to preserve the culture. So when I went to visit, I saw what the pupils were doing and how they were doing it. I could see how they related to Darda Rinpoche. Oh God, they just fall over him, you know. They just loved him. Time for their afternoon prayers, half an hour of chanting in Tibetan. Darda Rinpoche would come down. oh, Rinpoche is coming, and all the kids would run around, you know. And then they start off and they're chanting and singing. It was more like songs, really. But they weren't just songs, they were actually Dharma songs. Songs about compassion, songs about wisdom, songs about the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Songs about the Bodhisattva of wisdom, because for doing the studies they obviously needed wisdom. So they'd recite the mantra of the Bodhisattva wisdom, which goes, Om Arapajanadi. Yeah? Om Arapajanadi. But how they would chant it was, Om Arapajanadi. And to get the tongue to really do it fast, they go, the faster they could do it, they thought, yeah, this is the way we could actually, you know, learn to discipline our tongue. So every morning I'd hear them, you know, singing in their lines in the playground, and these songs are going. Then it would get to the Bodhisattva was, and then they'd all go, Om Arapajana, going and on. They were such fun. But there was something else that really struck me, apart from his practicality and his determination to keep the tradition alive. And it happened because I asked him to give me meditation practice. First thing he did was like, oh! And he sort of like bent over his little desk, oh my God, what the heck have I done? I've asked the wrong thing here. So after about a minute of this, he's like sat up and then he's like took out his dice, opened up the box and shook the dice. And I like shook a second time. And I thought he's really trying for a double six, but but that wasn't what he was doing. He was actually trying to determine by dice which meditation he should give me. If it was like such and such a combination, it would be Tara. If it was something else, it would be Bodhisattva wisdom. If it was so, yeah, he sort of said, okay, Dharma, Tara, green Tara. He'll give me a green Tara meditation. So he said, we'll do that first thing tomorrow morning. Okay, so the next morning, I'm there, you know, just sitting there warm in, you know, a freezing cold place, and it was in the winter, and Dharma Rinpoche on his high throne above me, I'm sitting below him. And there was lots of chanting and so on going on, things happening. I didn't understand it all fully, but there was one part he really wanted me to understand. And I've written about it in my new book, not the Dharma Rinpoche's life story. It's another new book, which I'm launching in 2 weeks in London. Some people have read it already. In the book, I explain what he said to me. He really made sure his translator told me exactly. So he said, Suvadra, I want you to visualize yourself as the female figure of Bodhisattva Tara. So Bodhisattva Tara, she's green and she's female. So I was like, you know, I've never visualized myself as a Buddha or Bodhisattva, let alone in a female form. I thought, this is going to be difficult. So he said, okay, so that's what I want you to do, to visualize yourself as Tara. And he said, now, I'm going to visualize myself as Tara. So you have to visualize me as Tara. So I'm down there thinking, I'm Tara, but he's Tara. So I have to visualize him as Tara. And then he said, and at the same time as that's going on, I'm visualizing you as Tara. So we're visualizing ourselves both as Tara and visualizing each other as Tara. So I mean, he checked, you know, does he understand it? Has he got it? Okay, right. After the whole thing was over, I'm thinking, what's going on there? And then it began to come to me, yes, what it's about is he's trying to visualize me at my absolute best as a bodhisattva. I'm not like that, but he's trying to visualize what I could be. And I've got to do the same with him. I've got to visualize him at his best, as the best I could imagine. He'd be like the Tara Bodhisattva, he'd be like the Buddha. And at the same time, we're visualizing each other like this, seeing from the best to the best in the other person. That's what he was trying to get at, that the nature of communication between the teacher and the disciple is to talk and teach from the highest in yourself to the highest in the other person. And they have to visualize themselves as they're at their absolute best and see me, Dharma Rinpoche, at my best. That's not just what happens between a teacher and a disciple. That's what should happen in communication. There is this teaching in Tibetan Buddhism that try and see everybody as a Buddha. Okay, yeah. But put it this way, communicate from the highest and best in yourself, the best that you can imagine for yourself, and to the best in somebody else. That's what communication should be like. That's what spiritual friendship should be like. The best in you to the best in each other. Not the worst in you to the worst in the other, which is a reactive pattern of communication. A non-reactive pattern is where you're doing this type of communication that he emphasized in that meditation practice. And as the years went on, I sort of got more and more out of this simple little teaching, he said. There was another one that he said, but I'm not going to go into it because we're going to do some question and answer also. But it was basically that I said to him, Rinpoche, I've never visualized myself in a female form before. Certainly not Tara, but never any female form. It's going to be difficult. So he said, no difference, male and female form, no difference. Both forms are ultimately empty. Empty, not in the sense of there's nothing there, but there's nothing fixed. There's no fixed essence in you. You're able to completely change. So I was like, wow. Okay, yeah, this is going to take a long time to fathom this out. And in a way, if you fathomed it out in its absolute depths, you'd be on the door of enlightenment. If you really saw that you were completely unfixed, and obviously, I'd have to see Dharma Rinpoche himself is also unfixed because he's visualizing himself as Tara too. So subject and object are both completely unfixed. If they're unfixed, they can change in any way, backwards or forwards. But us trying to visualize ourselves as bodhisattvas, obviously we're trying to become like the Buddhas or like the bodhisattvas. So that particular teaching is, yeah, it's one I'm still working on, and I guess I'll be working on for many, many decades. After that first visit, I went back a second time, and Rinpoche was asking me about all these questions I had, and okay, so we got more of the life story of him. But then we had a bit more extra time at one point, so he said, so any other questions? And I said, Rinpoche, when I saw you first time, I asked you for a meditation practice, and you doubled over and went, oh! And he laughed. I remember. Oh God, it wasn't my imagination. He remembered. So I said, why did you do that? You said that the progress in my meditation will depend on the faith I have in you as the Lama. So I always had this question afterwards, why did you do that? Oh, all right, okay. The reason was because after Sangharakshita left, I never really passed on any meditation practices, apart from one, he said, to any other Westerners. And I didn't know if you could do that or not. So I was in doubt, you know, oh God, what should I do? I'm supposed to teach. And he's asked me for a meditation practice. Will he be able to do it? He said, but then I thought, yes, he's a disciple of Sangharakshita. Obviously he can do it. So then he decided, okay, he'll give me the Tara meditation practice. So having got that explanation, I thought, okay, yeah, now I've got more full faith in the Lama. Because it really was quite a sort of a thing to be like thrown by the sort of the Rinpoche goes, oh. So I've come to the end of what I'd planned to say, and I thought, leave the last 15 minutes to you to see if you've got any questions you want to ask about Dardo Rinpoche, and Surya Gupta is going to help me field the floor.
I'll just end. Okay, yeah, thank you so much. I can already see there's so much more, isn't there?
Lots of stories.
But you've really given us a really good sense of his context and also his character, his personality has really come through. So, but yeah, any questions you have around Dada Rinpoche, the connection with Trimatna, anything that's,
So was Dada Rinpoche saying that he thought that people in India or Tibetans were more capable of meditating than Westerners?
No, I don't think I ever heard him talk about that. I don't think he did say that. I think he was... he hadn't had experience of teaching Westerners, apart from Sangharakshita, and he knew that Sangharakshita was really quite special because he'd never come across anybody who could understand and teach and practice it all at the same time. Usually, you know, you get a bit of it and then you start, okay, and you're not quite ready to tell other people, but you know, once you've practiced it a bit and you've thought about it, you can do all three. But you know, the loftiest ideals that he'd studied in his own monasteries and so on, Sangharakshita could do it. He could follow it.
Right, thank you.
Yeah, Natalie.
I wondered if you could describe what it felt like energetically to be in his presence.
What was the last word?
What it felt like energetically to be in his presence.
It's not sort of like a way I normally sum up my experience, at least certainly not at that time. I think maybe in the last few years of becoming to sort of like think in terms of like energetically, what's it like? But like he said in the video this morning that when he saw Sangharakshita doing all this, he thought, oh, this man is actually very capable. And he gave the analogy of where you see smoke, there's going to be fire. So in the same way, when you see somebody practicing Buddhism, putting it into effect, then you know, actually, this man has got some substance, or this person's got some substance. So that's how I sort of viewed him in that sense, that he was a bit like, well, you can't really sort of put your finger on it, but he's a bit like smoke. There's a definite fire underneath. You know there's something substantial, that's burning and you know, incandescent. But yeah, in terms of, you know, energetically, that's a language that you've been using today. It's not one that I normally use. But I'll tell you something else that brought out a slightly more cheeky side of him.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, on that second visit, on the second day, he got up and he said, oh, yesterday was bad weather. And also my mental state wasn't good. He said, today's bright and my mind is bright. So he said, now I'm going to test you guys. And I'm like, whoops. There were four of us there. He said, yes, yeah, I'm going to ask you questions and your answers will determine your quality. You're like, oh my God. Of course, that's sort of something that they do in the Tibetan debating tradition. They debate their philosophical arguments and they do this sort of incredible. And it's, I mean, I can't do it. I'd have to be like 6 foot and made of muscles. These guys, you know, they're not usually 6 foot, but it looks like it. The way they act and the robes are flying and boom, answer! And then you have to answer immediately. Any hesitation, you've lost. And they'll take their string of beads if you've hesitated, and they'll swing it over your head and say, you're confused. Well, Dharma Rinpoche was very, very rarely ever caught out like that. But, you know, we thought, oh my God, he's really going to catch us out, and he'll probably chant those two words, you're confused. Luckily, he didn't do that. But he had this playful side. And a determination, just everything. Just, he could be with the kids, he could be eating his food, he could be meditating, giving a teaching, but he was light with it, gentle with it, but very determined and one-pointed. Does that help? Give a bit more. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you know, like, how his sort of day-to-day looked like.
Mm.
So, I don't know when.
Yeah, his big day, his day started at 4 o'clock in the morning and didn't usually finish until round about 11 at night. Sometimes if it had been a busy day, it would go on to maybe 12 o'clock and he'd be up again at 4. So he'd start with visualizing himself as a bodhisattva when he got up, reciting mantras while he's washing himself, doing purification mantras. And it would go on like this. He'd have 6 hours from 4 o'clock through to 10 o'clock just doing his meditation practice. Once he finished, round about 11 o'clock, he'd start, 11 o'clock in the morning, he'd start working for the school, and he'd spend the rest of the day working for the school. Then in the evening, he'd do more meditation and prayers for people who died. As one of his regular prayers was to offer to the beings who died. So he'd, you know, have prayers, and he'd visualize lights of compassion going out. He'd burn incense. You know, actually not sticks of incense, but more like what do you call it? Like frankincense powder. So like put it on the charcoal fire and then the smoke would go out, and beings in another realm can appreciate the scent of smoke, whereas, you know, other things they can't really, you know, they don't live on scent. But in other realms, they do live in scent. So he'd have this day where he'd just be half the day, well, half from 4 o'clock in the morning till 10, 6 hours of meditation, and then more in the evening. and the rest of the day for running the school. And you know, he did things like he ran electricity cables for the school. He made table lamps for the school. He learned electrics when he came to India, first of all, when he became the abbot of that monastery in India that the Tibetan government had sent him to. He did expand it, but he learned lots of things like plumbing, brickwork, cement laying, electrics, and especially electrics. He liked doing electrics. He also took a photograph of every pupil in the school, and he would develop the photographs himself, print them, one for him and one for the pupil. And he did that right up until nearly the end, and his attendant's family were saying, "Rinpoche, look, just go as far as the negative only. Get them to print, give them the negative, and then they can print it." So yeah, he had to sort of like in the end capitulate. He also, the parents of the children would give him money to give to the children for their pocket money. So every day he would give them a little coin. Not at the end of the week, every day. And they'd all sit in this in a special order, and he would give it, and he would write in the book, and he did double entry accounting. he learned accounting.
Just leave it.
You said the school closed down. Why did it close down, and what happened to the students?
Well, nowadays it's very hard to find a poor refugee from Tibet. There's not many refugees come out of Tibet nowadays. It's difficult to come out. But also, you know, those who are coming out are not the poorest. It's usually monks that come out to try and get education in the southern India monasteries. So that's one thing that actually, as a school, a charitable school to help the poor, very difficult. And you hardly get orphans up in that area. And for the previous 5-10 years before it closed down, most of the poor that came from not Tibet but from Nepal. They came from, you know, village areas in distant parts of Nepal, and where there was no real, you know, teaching and education in schools at all. So a lot of the children came from there. So yes, they decided that the mission in a way had been fulfilled. They'd done as much as they could, and that it was now a different project. So they decided to just gently close it. I think they were all quite sad, but in a way it was a natural conclusion. Yeah.
I was going to ask
you
the same
question,
but
okay.
I have got a second question. You said he was chosen as an incarnate. Is there a basic process of how they decide who the incarnate is?
Yeah, there is.
I mean, there's probably a long process, but...
Well, usually some big lama meditates and says, "Oh, you know, go to the east." Yeah, okay. You know, how far east? Oh, long way east. Well, long way east from Lhasa takes you to Dartsendo. So that was the instruction for our Rinpoche here, that it was said, go east. But also they thought, well, Dartsendo, because the family had come from that area, the previous Rinpoche had come from that area, maybe the soul had gone back to that area. So then the next thing that happens is that they usually find a candidate who's a kid that has said stuff like, "Oh, actually, I don't live here. I live in a big monastery far away." Well, why would they say that if they're born into an ordinary family? So, well, Tibetans are always keeping an eye out for this sort of thing, because then it means, you know, oh, shut the boy up, because we don't want him to be taken away by the monastery. It's just families don't often want their kids to go to the monastery, but if it's a big lama, then the pressure's put on. And it was the same for this Rinpoche. To confirm it, the monks who come to do the testing have got a bunch of things, like a string of beads, another one nearly identical but slightly different, a cup, a vajra bell, and the boy has to pick out all the right ones. Now, Dalai Lama, in an interview, says that you can find it on YouTube, that he was asked to pick out the things, and he did. But when he got to where the previous Dalai Lama had lived, he opened up the cupboard and said, my teeth are in here. And they opened up and there was a pair of false teeth. The previous Dalai Lama's false teeth. So that really confirmed it. But Dada Rinpoche himself didn't have much faith in the system of finding the right lamas, and he said he didn't want to be recognised again. One of his own main teachers, said that to him, that he didn't want to be recognised again. So Dada Rinpoche didn't want to. But when it came to it, the monks have got their own power. And they say, no, we have to do it. We have to find him.
So there is a.
So there is another Daldur Tulku still going through the education process. Poor guy. I've known him since he was 2 years old. He's 32 years old, I think, now, and he hasn't finished his education. He got to about 4 years ago. The Dalai Lama suddenly said, I'm putting an extra 6 years on the syllabus because you guys are not the same quality as the old lamas. So this new Dada Rinpoche, he's still got another 2 years left to go.
Yeah. Well, a couple more and then we finish, yeah.
Yeah.
Tara and then Izzy.
Yeah, I was wondering if Dada Rinpoche gave you any other practices to do, because I manage our social media here and I posted some of the clip that was on earlier, and an order member who was with you when you made the film commented, was really moved, I can't remember the name, but was saying that you would give, I don't know if it was you or if it was their experience, but given the Manjugosha sitting practice?
No, I never got the Manjugosha practice from him. Another order member, Guna Badri, she got given the Bodhisattva of Wisdom practice. But when I went the second time, I'd already received a meditation from him, so I said, I don't want to, ask for any other meditations. But three other friends were with me, members of our order. And Mokshananda from Spain, he said that he wanted the meditation practice of the five Buddhas. And Dada Rinpoche said, well, there's no specific meditation of the five Buddhas. Each of them individually, yes, but not all five together. And then he said, I could make one up. But he said, that's not the way that it's done. It's really the Buddhas would have to give me the meditation practice. It has to come from that source. That's where the inspiration would come from. So it's not really proper for me to make it up. Okay, so Mokshananda's choice was out. But we'd already discussed this in advance, that if Rinpoche said no, he didn't have the five Buddha practice, and there wasn't one, then Moksha Priya would ask, because when he asked for ordination, he couldn't decide what to ask for. So he said it could be Vajrasattva, it could be Avalokiteshvara, it could be, Padmasambhava, I think. I can't remember, actually. There were three. So Bhante said, I'll give you all three. But he didn't give the mantra for Vajrasattva. So he was going to ask Dada Rinpoche for Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva is a white bodhisattva. It's not on the shrine, is he? No. That's got a vajra here and a bell here and represents ultimate purity. So Rinpoche said, yeah, okay, Vajrasattva tomorrow morning. Vajrasattva's white. Vajrasattva's always white. Am I right? Okay. Right. Aniruddha is he's an Indian order member. He's translating from Hindi, Rinpoche's Hindi, into English. And he says, Aniruddha says to us, Rinpoche says, visualize yourself as Vajrasattva, yellow in color. No. He didn't say yellow. He said white. No. He said yellow. I said, no, it's Safed. Pilanaiye. Pilanaiye. And Rinpoche is like, what the hell's going on here? So then Aniruddha asks, did you say yellow Vajrasattva or white? Yellow. He said, I said yellow. Okay. We're all confused now. We got to the end of the practice. And then he said, so okay, any questions? So the first question, of course, is, you know, why did you give us yellow Vajrasattva? Oh, well, I was looking in my book of practices and I couldn't find the white one. So I saw a yellow one and I thought, that's suspicious. We'll give the yellow one. So we ended up with a yellow Vajrasattva. Yellow is Vajrasattva in the mode of increase and bounty, like the sun on the crops brings out golden crops. So the yellow is always associated with abundance. And he wanted long life for us, merit for us, and wisdom. So we got a meditation practice that brought out those things. There you go.
Wow.
So I wasn't going to have that, but he said, no, you all have to have it. Yeah.
Wow, great. Is this your question still live?
Yeah. I was just interested in what the learning consists of. It's like so many years or even like more than a decade of studying. What are they studying? What kind of, what's the syllabus?
The Geshe training.
Everything. Mm. Everything, right from the beginning of ethics, meditation, wisdom texts, and the studying mainly by learning the text by heart and reciting it aloud. And I later on saw that down in South India when I went to some of the monasteries down there. I was asked, along with some friends, look, you know, this young Rinpoche, he's very naughty, and me, the teacher, is going out, and we want you to keep an eye on him. And he's got to learn up to, you know, he's got to recite up to page such and such, and then he's got to learn the next page. So, you know, the young boy opens up the text and on and on and on, page after page after page after page. Then learn the next page. Okay, got it. Wow, man, it was just astounding. You could just learn a page, just in 2 or 3 minutes. So, I mean, they were learning mostly commentaries on the texts, phenomenology, epistemology, logic, ethics, the basics of meditation, all the stages of the path. Every stage has got subsections, like 10 subsections, and the first of those 10 subsections has got like 3 main headings, and out of those 3 main headings, the first heading has got 4 subsections and 2 sub-subsections, and they learn the whole structure and all the words that go with each of the parts of the structure, and they have to, in their exams, tell the whole structure and what comes before, what comes after any particular quote. It's an astounding performance, but it shows what the mind can do. if it's trained. And best way to train, you get the young boys. The nuns didn't. The nuns got it easy. They didn't have to learn so much. I think they were really lucky. But the monks, before breakfast, they had to learn, you know, like a page before they got their breakfast, and recite all the previous pages that they'd learned on previous days. No new, any mistakes, or no new learning, no breakfast. So, yeah, the boys learned pretty quickly.
Wow.
Yeah, imagine Suri Gupta says, okay, we've finished meditation now, we'll go for lunch. Oh, but by the way, you have to learn.
I think it does, you know, because when I was there, I went to one of Bhante's teachers, Dujon Rinpoche's house, and met some of the monks there. And one of them had been practicing for 15 years. He'd just started learning to meditate. So the previous 15 years was study, and the recitation and learning. And he was very excited to be learning, meditation that we do as soon as we come. So I think it shows you what you've explained there. It shows you how different Bhante Sangharakshita, what he did, that how different it was to the tradition, how much it was adapted really to what we actually need and can actually make good use of here.
Yeah.
So.